Hey, everybody. Welcome to the NYC Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm also one of the owners of EBMG, a property management company in New York City, and it is a pleasure to be with you today. My guest today is Stephen Lasser. He is the managing partner of the Lasser Law Group. Hey, Stephen.
Hey.
Good to have you on. Yeah, thanks for coming on. Before we get into you, Steve, I'll let everybody know that they can email the show at nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. Steven, so you've been an attorney for a long time. I figured I would give you a little bit of a moment to describe how you got here, what your past has been, what your experience and expertise is, and then I'm happy to move forward into what we wanted to talk about today.
Sure. So, I've been practicing law for over 20 years. I've been probably working in the real estate industry for probably 25, almost 30 years. And I've just always had an interest in real estate. I actually worked for some developers and property managers before I went to law school at night, and then started practicing law. And eventually, I worked at a couple of firms and eventually just decided to open my own shop. And I've been doing this for about 10 years. And our main office is in Manhattan. We service Westchester, Long Island, and the Hudson Valley. And we have a thriving co-op condo and HOA practice, but we also handle landlord-tenant matters, zoning matters, bankruptcy, construction, and other legal issues related to the construction and real estate industry as well.
So I like having lawyers on the show because so much of what we deal with is kind of adjacent to what you do. But we need you. Like, we need to rely on you. We need to rely on your expertise. One thing that we were discussing before we put together the show is really going into detail with non-payment collections. And there are two different ways that we could go about it, because we manage a variety of, let's say, co-ops, and then we have condos, and each one is set up different in the way that the organization is, the type of ownership that it is, it's either maintenance or it's common charges if it's a condo. But there are certain things that we could probably do on both sides of that, where boards can really put their best foot forward and just better practice to try to minimize as much as possible the outlay of cash on their end for not getting the receivables that they need to pay their bills. But once we do get past that, friendly stage of reaching out to, let's say, the unit owners or reaching out to the shareholders, now we have to go towards legal, and we don't want to do that. Obviously, there's a big expense to that, both socially, emotionally, and also financially for all these people that are involved in this. And while there are some good actors in terms of payments, non-payments, and they want to make it better and they communicate with us, we still have those that are everywhere who are not responding to us. They're not getting back to us in writing or over the phone. So that's when we call upon you guys for starting the procedures against either the shareholders or the unit owners in a condo. So can you walk us through, I guess, the difference in the condo versus co-op, how a non-payment collection would be, how it would take place? Are there any differences in court? Are there any differences in essentially what we're providing to them?
Sure. So I think you made a good point there about, that the ownership forms are different. So, I'd like to sort of just give a brief sort of overview of the ownership forms, because I think that sort of explains a lot of the different procedures you'd use. And the other thing that I think is interesting is, the concept of lien priorities, because the lien priorities in co-ops and condos are different. And that also will sort of influence the strategies that, your legal strategies that you utilize. So just real briefly, a lien is an interest in or a legal claim to a piece of property, which allows the holder of the lien to legally seize and dispose of the property secured by the lien when a debtor fails to fulfill its financial obligations. So basically, most people are familiar with mortgages, right? You get a loan from a bank, and if you don't pay the loan, they foreclose and take back the property. So, I think nearly everyone is familiar with that concept. And that concept sort of pervades co-ops and condos, and also HOAs, which are, you know, basically analogous to condos. And depending on the lien priority and the ownership structure, you know, that will sort of dictate how you would proceed. So, you know, I could talk about the ownerships forms. So the ownership forms for co-ops, condos, and HOAs are different, but they're all sort of similar, Mark. And I'm sure, I don't know if you know, your experience is this is the same, but basically, you know, the if you own this property, if you own a co-op, condo, or an HOA, the owner is responsible for the interior, the association is responsible for the exterior. You get tax deductions for your mortgage and, you know, real estate tax payments, and you have to live by the rules of the community. I think that's basically the same. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, and do you think, you know, just from your perspective, do you see like any major differences? I mean, like if you just say from a user experience, if you're in a co-op or a condo, or from a management experience, like, are there any sort of big differences? I mean, obviously the legal ownership is different, but like just the data.
Yeah, I think I personally, and then this probably is counter to a lot of people in my industry, I personally like the structure of a co-op a little bit better than the condo. I feel like the way that you live within the proprietary lease has a little bit more structure and a lot more teeth to it. And I feel like sometimes a condo, especially the newer condos that are being built, and with some of the new ownership that comes in, I think that it's a little bit more loosey-goosey, feels more like the wild, wild west, because the board may not have as much say over, you know, the potential interviews of people coming into the building. And I'm not saying in any way discriminatory in any way, but when you are a co-op, you have a lot more of an ability to have the board say no to an applicant because they don't feel that they would be able to financially afford what's, you know, coming in based on their level of debt, you know, to income, or their financial conditions or anything else. So as long as we're staying within the confines of the law and we're not discriminating against, but when you go to the condo, you find that it's a lot of developers are obviously, you know, and especially on the new construction selling, there's not much oversight in that turnover period, because you do have the developer on the board as opposed to, you know, the unit owners. And then it's a little bit chaotic when it switches over to the new board and getting that new management team in place. But going back to the proprietary lease and the bylaws, like for me, it's a very narrow approach when looking at a co-op. I feel like we have to get a little bit wider on our understanding of what everybody should expect when we're in a condo.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. So, you know, with a co-op, right, just real quick, I know you know this, but for the benefit of the viewers and listeners, the you know, the co-op is created, you have a building or a parcel of land, and the developer is going to break that up into homes or to apartments, but they don't typically break down individual tax lots. So there's just one tax lot, and there's all these apartments, and there's also typically an underlying mortgage or a construction loan that covers the entire property. And the developer usually just sells the individual, basically gets permission from the attorney general to sell the apartments or the homes. And they don't create separate tax lots for each unit, and they don't remove the underlying mortgage. So when you're buying into a co-op, you're typically buying, you know, basically a shared tax lot with your neighbors, and you're also buying into a mortgage obligation, you know, with your neighbors as well. You get a proprietary lease, you get shares allocated to your specific apartment, which basically gives you the right to use that, you know, apartment exclusively in perpetuity. But you do have that sort of joint relationship with your neighbors. And then the other thing is that you have that first layer of the underlying mortgage. If you purchase your apartment with financing, then you're going to have a second layer of financing. You know, they call that an end loan typically. And this is where the lien priority comes into play, is that statutorily there's, you know, the Uniform Commercial Code, and known as the UCC. And the UCC says that in a co-op, your maintenance obligation to the co-op, there's a lien there, even though there's not a physical lien recorded, but you have a sort of springing lien that when you become a shareholder, that your maintenance obligation is going to have priority over any end loan that you take out to purchase your unit. And then basically your lender will make you sign what's called a recognition agreement. That recognition agreement says that if you default in your maintenance payment, the co-op will notify the lender, the co-op association will notify the lender. And if there's a default in the end loan by the shareholder, that the lender will notify the co-op. But because the co-op has lien priority with its maintenance, typically when I'm dealing with a non-payment case, the first thing we do is we check to see if there's an end loan, and we notify the lender. And typically the lender will pay the maintenance, because if they do not, and the co-op proceeds to evict the shareholder, which I'll talk about in a second, if they proceed with a non-payment proceeding and then sell the apartment, then the lender on the end loan might not recoup their loan back. So,
yeah. And we've used that successfully over a period of time. And I'm even surprised that there are some shareholders in some buildings who for years refused to pay their maintenance. And this is like on cycle, like 3 months non-payment, go back to the lender pays it, and then they'll deal with it on their own. 3 more months comes by, we've done all the due diligence on our side and followed the procedures, go back to the lender. Okay, we're paying it. And it's surprising. They do want to work with you. Obviously, they don't want to lose their collateral and their loan, as you said. And that's one tool. There are some buildings that I've had where, and I know we're kind of getting off topic, but staying on topic at the same point, where I've had buildings that have discussed not allowing cash purchases for this very reason. And you might make the argument both ways that, look, if somebody has so much cash and will have so much cash left over after buying this apartment, should we really care? And my answer reverts back to this discussion. Yes, because what if they don't pay their maintenance? I would rather have the bank on the line to say, hey, we are not being made whole. We are coming to you before we go non-payment and eviction. Will you be satisfying the requirements of their maintenance? And more often than not, as we just spoke about, they'll just pay it and work it out on their end. So there is a risk to not taking a mortgage, for a purchaser. And that's just something that I kind of picked up over the last few years that was definitely made it easier for us.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, because I was just thinking that it's almost better if there is. I think the more difficult cases are when there is no mortgage. And I never thought about it from like a policy perspective, but maybe that is a good idea for not to require all cash purchasers, because then you get into that weird situation where you can't notify the lender and they're not paying their maintenance. And that brings up like another point, is that I've had people say to me, our clients, prospective clients, are like, well, why can't we just do a UCC sale? Because basically, what you have that lien, right? You have that UCC lien for unpaid maintenance. Why don't we just sell the apartment? Why do we have to go to landlord-tenant court? And in my experience, there's case law that says that you need to get a warrant of eviction and go through the non-payment proceeding first, because if you don't, basically what you're doing is you're allowing a co-op board to sell someone's apartment without having any sort of judicial oversight. And there's case law that says that that's against public policy and you can't do that. Now, I've seen situations where not my firm, but other firms have done that. They've just done a UCC sale and then sort of sold the apartment, but then let the purchaser deal with the eviction. But I think if the shareholder takes that case to court, it's going to get overturned. That sale is not going to be upheld.
Yeah.
Now, you might want to just scare the shareholder and say that you're doing a sale, but I don't think you're really going to get away with that if the case is litigated. So unfortunately you do have to go to a landlord-tenant court typically if someone doesn't pay, and if all else fails. I mean, I know you talked about reaching out to the shareholder, and I think that's always obviously the best thing. You said there's sort of social and implications. You're dealing with people's homes, you're dealing with their neighbors. I don't think any co-op board wants to put someone out on the street, so to speak, but your last resort is eviction proceeding, but sometimes you have to do that in order to, there's just odd circumstances, right? Just like you said, there's a cash buyer and they're not paying. Like how could they have enough money to buy a co-op in New York, but still not be able to pay their maintenance? But
right.
Things happen, right?
Yeah. And also some people don't want to pay their maintenance. Some people don't want to pay the assessment. Some people don't want to pay the garage fees. Yeah. So all those are important. And I think from a policy perspective, I know we broached a little bit of a policy with some boards how they view cash sales. But when it comes to what are the policies for late payments, what are the policies for missed payments in a co-op, I think that especially in the house rules, there should be some sort of a factor in there that says, you know, this is the policy so that we could be consistent on every shareholder's account. And instead of going to court and showing that, oh, well, this was an arbitrary either late fee, this was an arbitrary legal proceeding, it didn't happen to the other person, you can argue that. So to have it set in stone where in the house rules, it says that the late payment structure is this. You get your letter, let's say on the 15th of the first month when you don't receive the maintenance, and then you go to the next month and it's a $50 late fee plus it's another letter. And then it's also saying, hey, if it's not paid by the third month, then we will escalate this to legal at the shareholder's cost. I think if we have that set in stone, it's good. And I've always had the opinion that we are not, as managing agents, debt collectors. So we are not coming at it from a place of, you know, trying to beat somebody over the head and say, you have to pay or else. We've always been given the advice for the last 15 plus years that keep it friendly, keep it open. Hey, just a friendly, this is how I tell all my staff to do it. Just a friendly reminder that your maintenance is due in the amount of X amount. And we would really appreciate a call back so that we could go over a payment plan if you need one, or we could figure out how to get you to a zero balance. But you could also say nicely, if we don't hear back from you, we will, you know, continue through the process that's given to us in the governing documents. And I think that's a way of taking some of the sting out of it. A lot of people, from my experience, also are embarrassed if you can't pay your bills, and it's not because you don't want to, but because you can't. So you also have to kind of handle that graciously from our end until you're given a reason not to. So we always try to come at it from a customer service perspective to say, you know, how can we help? How can we let the board know that we're working on this together? Can we work out a deal where we're able to get you up and running in the next 3 months so that you're whole? That is, I know you know, lawyers and managing agents, we have other things to do. You know, we would love it if you could probably take some of this off of our plate by paying the maintenance so that we could get on to like the real issues that are happening in the building, and we need to pay for those real issues. And I guess the same I would say for a condo, but what is the process? So let's say in a co-op, let's go co-op only first and then we'll move over to condo. In a co-op, I've got 3 months non-payment. I push this over to you now as counsel, and I say, okay, we've got, here's your ledger. Here's the last year of payments or missed payments. Here you go. Please, you know, start the process. What does that look like from the legal perspective?
Yeah. So you have to, there's due to the HSTPA, which now currently applies to co-ops, or at least in most respects, the, you know, Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act of 2018, you have to send basically like a late notice, and you serve a 14 day rent demand notice. So, I mean, this is if you're, you know, you're already in sort of in the legal process. And then after those notices expire, you start a housing court case by filing a petition with the, you know, local court to start, you know, an eviction proceeding. And then, you know, of course, along the way, you know, maybe you'll get a call from them, or you'll notify the lender, so maybe they'll make a payment. And then, you know, if you know, worst case scenario, you end up in housing court, you know, worst case scenario, because it's not good for the shareholder, and it's also, you know, it's just not a great place to litigate. Period. Not the place you want to be, especially on the residential side. And you know, then you go through that court process, and you know, they really encourage repayment plans versus evictions. You know, there's a separate part in the housing court for co-ops specifically. And, you know, it's just sort of, there's different issues there. You know, you talk about a homeowner, not a short-term rental where it's, you know, typically a 1 year lease. So, and there's a lot more at stake. And I think that the judges really go out of their way to try to make something work, a repayment plan work. That's usually.
Now, have you seen a difference pre-COVID versus I don't want to say post-COVID because it's still around, but we're kind of nearing the end of, I guess, people viewing, like, now we were talking before we got on about like remote working and, you know, a lot of these things that were put into place during COVID are not in play right now. People are back in the office, judges are back in court. What is the time frame that you're seeing from start to finish? If there's really not too many hiccups on a case, are we looking at 9 months? Are we looking at 12 months, 18 months?
I think 9 months is realistic, but, like, you know, it depends on the case. Like, if there's, you know, government money involved or something like that, things can get dragged out if they have an ERAP application or something. And then just generally, I would say that the courts are still severely backed up. I mean, things are getting processed now, but there's definitely a backlog. So if you can avoid going to court, I would definitely advise that you do.
Which makes even more sense to have that outreach that we were talking about, because if we could avoid 9 months of this, while, let's say you have on a round number, let's just say maintenance is $500 a month, and now we've got late fees, we've got maintenance backing up, but we've got 9 months of court fees, we've got 9 months of yours, and I'm assuming that we could bill back the shareholder for any legal expenses that were as the result of their non-payment that the co-op incurred. So you're going to get some of that back at the end, but the co-op has to foot that for the beginning. You know, we can't not pay you. We have to keep that machine moving. So by not trying to work it out, you could be out in this lowest case scenario, $5,000 plus any fees that we have to pay for a little bit more expensive common maintenance charges in a co-op. You could be looking at tens of thousands, depending on the building. So it really is in our best interest to try to nail these things before they get out of control.
Yeah, and I always find that to sort of piggyback on what you're saying, I find that when we have a conversation with someone, you know, they get a notice and they contact us, it could be because they're embarrassed or whatever the case may be. But once you get a phone call in with them, they're usually actually appreciative that you're making an effort to work it out. And I think most people do want to work things out. They don't want to go to court. Obviously, there are situations where you mentioned that people don't want to pay their maintenance and they're doing it intentionally. But oftentimes it's an oversight, you know, that maybe there's an increase in the maintenance or there's a death or there's some kind of factor going on in the background. And if you're able to get hold of someone and speak with them, then more often than not, they do want to work out some kind of repayment plan.
So in a co-op, we're in this process of going to legal. We've gone to court. You're going back and forth. We've noted that traditionally they're more tenant friendly than landlord friendly. I think that's just New York City, and that's always been. And the way that I view a co-op and the way that the judges would also is more of a rental type situation, because there's the protections of the proprietary lease. You don't actually, as a shareholder, own your apartment. You own shares in the corporation that owns the building, and you have a right, as you said, to live there in perpetuity, so long as you're abiding by the terms of your agreement there. We get to the end of this process. We're in court. They've decided that there's going to be no repayment. This person, shareholder, is not going to be able to pay. What is the process now of eviction? And then how does the apartment, which is owned by the shareholder, now move to new ownership? What does that look like?
So when you basically get a warrant of eviction, a judgment of possession, a warrant of eviction from the court, and then they'll schedule an eviction that usually takes a few weeks. And then, you know, it's kind of brutal, but if the person's actually there, they'll physically remove them from the apartment, and they'll take an inventory of what's there, and you'll put it in storage. Typically the person knows what's happening, and they'll move out, or they'll sort of like let you just sort of complete the eviction and make arrangements to have their stuff retrieved at a later date. And then the next step in the process would be selling the apartment. And that's done through a broker, or you could do it through an auction. And the Uniform Commercial Code has a standard that has to be commercially reasonable. So, and you know, commercially reasonable isn't defined, but it could be a broker or it could be an auction. And basically, as long as it's done in a process that, you know, achieves an amount that is, I guess you could say, reasonable, then that'll be okay. So, if you follow those procedures, you will get a reasonable price. Like, you can't have a broker go out and then list it for something below value and sell it to one of their friends and then flip it. Like, that wouldn't be upheld as being commercially reasonable. And you know, in co-ops, typically, you know, if there, my experience, because there's, you know, a vetting process with respect to, you know, financing, and that the board has a lot of control over it, usually the apartment's worth more than whatever the loan is, or there is no loan. So, you know, the shareholder will get some money on the back end. And, you know, it's just usually one of those weird circumstances where, like, it's an estate sale or there's someone that's ill, that there's usually some kind of extenuating circumstance that results in one of these sales. It's not, you know, a typical, you know, situation where someone was actually living there and they had purchased the unit. You know, maybe it's someone, a relative of someone that's just squatting in there. It's not usually the shareholder themselves,
Yeah.
in my experience.
So the apartment will be sold, hopefully for market value. Once that changes hands and the closing has happened and the funds have been cleared, the balance of whatever is due to that shareholder, minus any fees that were incurred that we're settling up at closing for legal, for late fees, for penalties, anything that is legally able to be charged per the proprietary lease, would then be distributed to the rightful owner of those shares at that time of the eviction.
Right. Or if there's a loan on the apartment after the co-op gets paid, you know, due to lien priority, the lender would get paid next. And also, this applies to co-ops and condos, taxes get paid first.
Right.
So if there was like a federal tax lien on a shareholder, then they would probably get paid first, and then co-op would get, you know, get second, sort of second dibs, and then the lender would get third dibs, and then if there's anything left, that would go to the shareholder.
Right. So moving over, so that's a co-op. Moving over to a condo, we explained that co-op is basically you own the shares in the corporation, the shares are allocated to your unit. A condo is a little bit different because each individual unit has its own fee simple ownership where you own, it's real property, it's not shares. So you own real property. You also own the Schedule A of the offering plan will tell you what your general interest is and the what your percentage of the common elements you own as well. So the bigger apartments traditionally have a larger percentage, so you're paying common charges based on that amount. You are running into a different situation than a co-op, especially on the when you're purchasing side, because yes, there's a right of first refusal in many condos where the board could say we're going to step into this transaction as the purchaser as opposed to the person who is coming to apply to live in the building. And that's generally to kind of ward off those friendly sales of, you know, the, you know, I'm selling it to my sister for $10, like that kind of thing to keep it in the family. They don't want that because that will screw the that will really screw up the comps in the building
Right.
and have some maybe some issues with, you know, payments in the future. How does it look from a standpoint of the board with a non-payment here and with the understanding that we're doing the same thing from management's perspective, sending out the letter, sending out the late fees. And the late fees are often in the bylaws where you know you could charge a percentage up to X percent, or you can charge a late fee of this much money. So we are kind of, unless we update the bylaws for where they are today, maybe it's a condo that was built in the 80s, and maybe it's a good time to update the bylaws anyway, because it's been 40 years. But what can a building do as a condo board to handle non-payments in a condo?
Yeah, so the differences, you know, in the form of ownership and the lien priority sort of dictate what you can do. And when a condo is built or it's converted from a residential rental building, or if it's built from the ground up, the developer creates separate tax lots. So we're in a co-op, you have, you know, one or two tax lots for the entire building. Here you have individual tax lots, so everyone's paying their own real estate taxes. And then also at the time of the conversion or sale, when someone purchases their unit, if there was an underlying mortgage or a construction loan, a pro rata share that was allocated to that apartment gets taken out, right? So basically, you only have one layer of financing, whereas in a co-op, you might have the underlying mortgage, and then you have your end loan when you purchase. In a condo, you're just going to have that sort of end loan or purchase loan. And the lien priority, and also you'll get a deed when you purchase. So instead of getting a proprietary lease, you're getting a deed that, as you mentioned, you get fee ownership, fee simple ownership, and it would be the same thing for an HOA. So now you own the unit outright or with a loan, and then you have the common interest with your neighbors. There is no landlord tenant relationship, so you can't get evicted. So that remedy isn't available. You can't go to landlord tenant court, and then also the lien priority is the inverse of a co-op. So basically a condo has a lien for unpaid common charges. It doesn't spring automatically like it does for a co-op, pursuant to the Uniform Commercial Code. In a condo, you actually have to file a lien. So the condo board would have to file a lien against the unit if someone doesn't pay their common charges. And that lien is going to be junior to a first purchase mortgage, a first purchase money mortgage on the unit. So you have this lien priority that's different from a co-op, whereas in a co-op, you could just notify the lender and they have an incentive to pay you. You don't have that in a condo. If you notify the lender more times than not, they're not going to pay you. So the way you collect common charges is there's just basically two methods. Is you can sue for breach of contract, or you can sue under a theory of lien foreclosure. And the breach of contract is when you purchase and you get your deed, that's a contract with a contract with the condo association or the HOA, and you're agreeing to pay the common charges and abide by all the rules of the declaration and bylaws. So you can sue for breach of contract, or you can do called a lien foreclosure. You file a lien and you foreclose against the property like you would with a mortgage. But and actually you could do both at the same time. That's typically what we recommend, depending on how much money is owed. But foreclosures take longer, and it's just against the property. With the money judgment breach of contract action, you could potentially go after a person's wages or their bank account, or you could do what's called a sheriff sale if you get a money judgment. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Mark, but instead of doing a foreclosure, you can do a sheriff sale, which is you just get the money judgment, which is quicker than a foreclosure. And it's like, I call it like the quick and dirty sale. You can still sell the unit, but the idea behind a foreclosure is you wipe out junior liens. That's the whole purpose of a foreclosure action. Whereas a sheriff sale, you just sell it whatever other liens are on the property. But I find in New York, typically there'll be people that are willing to purchase at a sheriff sale, even if there are other liens on the property. Not always, but oftentimes people will, be willing to sort of spin or roll the dice and purchase. And then back to the lien priority issue, it's not going to make sense for a condo to do a lien foreclosure if there's a first mortgage on the unit that is substantial and there's not a lot of equity there, because it wouldn't make sense for the condo completes its own lien foreclosure. A, if the bank is already foreclosing, the bank might be able to sell the unit before the condo does and wipe out the condo's lien. And then also, even if the condo sort of beat the lender to the punch, no one's going to buy a unit if there's 40, let's say $50,000 in common charges and a $400,000 mortgage. And, at auction, there's only $50,000 of equity. If someone has to fix it up, it's just not going to make sense. If the unit's worth $500,000, people aren't going to probably risk purchasing a unit at foreclosure at market value. If the market value is $500, when there's a $400,000 mortgage and $50,000 in common charges, only $50,000 of equity there, it's not going to make sense. So, from a sort of risk perspective as a purchaser, so we always evaluate cases on condo collection cases on a case-by-case basis. We, we talk with the managers and the board and, see, what do we think the unit's worth? We investigate whether there's a first mortgage on the unit, whether that's in foreclosure. And then, we explore possible other remedies. Like I said, if you do the you know, breach of contract case, you know, maybe we know where the person's employed, or we know that they have other assets. And the other thing I always suggest is if the person doesn't owe a lot of money, you can go to small claims court in the city for up to $10,000, and in outside the city for, I think the limit is $5,000, and you can get a money judgment there. Now, you probably wouldn't do a sheriff's sale with a money judgment for $10,000, but you might, you know, be able to go after the person's wages or just get their attention. So I would sort of always recommend exploring both the lien foreclosure and a money judgment.
And talking about process again, I think something that is very helpful that we do, and this is also very important in condo side, but we do it also on the co-op side, is any application that we have for a renter or a subtenant to come into the building, we have both the unit owner and the tenant sign, and in a co-op, the shareholder and the subtenant sign that says, should the owner or the shareholder run into a situation with arrears, we as the board have the right to go directly to the renter to, for the period of time until we are made whole, to grab the rent from them directly. So that, let's say, you know, you've got a renter paying $3,000 a month for rent, and the common charges, you know, you're at $9,000 out of payment. So now it'll take 3 months to make it back, and they won't be getting any of their revenue as the unit owner from the tenant, but we will, to be made whole. So that's also another workaround to try to get everybody on less of a defensive footing from the beginning.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think doing, you know, rent collections from this, from the tenant or subtenant is definitely, you know, a great sort of workaround strategy. Doesn't always work. And also I agree also that more usually in my experience, the people that aren't paying are oftentimes people with tenants, or I'd say at least 50%. So it's pretty prevalent, and they are, if they are collecting rent and not paying the common charges, that's really, you know, not fair, because they're actually making money, you know, percent right, each month. So they should be able to pay their common charges.
Yes, that is always an investment tool, a revenue tool for them. And that goes into also the importance of charging fees in buildings for subleasing or for leasing fees. And it's because it is an investment for somebody. Somebody is making revenue on it. And those are discussions that the buildings, you know, should have on their own if they're not.
Yeah, adding to that, you know, I mentioned that in a condo, you have to file a lien in order to foreclose. But I think just generally, from a collection standpoint, if someone owes more than a few months common charges in a condo, it's very inexpensive to file a lien. And that will prevent someone from, you know, refinancing or selling, especially if there's like no right of first refusal in the building. So that sort of ensures that the condo will get paid. And also, if the person declares bankruptcy, it makes you a secured creditor, whereas, you know, on a co-op, you're automatically a secured creditor. Like in a condo, you wouldn't be. So filing that lien would help if someone declares bankruptcy. And I've not seen that many bankruptcies now, but, you know, I don't have a great sort of outlook for the second half of 2023. We'll see. But I think there's an uptick in bankruptcies. So, you know, if you're a condo manager or board member, I definitely recommend filing a lien if someone is more than a few months behind.
We said on the co-op side that it takes in general 9 months from start to finish for these things. If on the condo side, for filing a lien or sheriff's, like, how, what's the time frame? I imagine they're all different because it's playing by a different set of rules. But is there any sort of expectation of time or worst case scenario?
Yeah, so I think if you're suing for a money judgment, I think you can get that within a year, and probably do a sheriff's sale within a year and a half. You know, and if you get a money judgment, you can go after someone's wages or bank accounts. That's, you know, within a year. If you actually do a lien foreclosure, I think that's, you're probably looking at, you know, 1.5 to 2 years. So, you know, that's a long time, especially if the person's not paying. I mean, you could seek a rent receiver during that, but that's not always the easiest thing to obtain. And by the time you get the rent receiver set up, and if you have to fix up the apartment, it, you know, there's a lot of variables. So yeah, it's definitely, I would always recommend to boards to pursue a money judgment in a condo context, and they can simultaneously pursue the lien foreclosure, but, you know, you might get lucky with the money judgment action. So it's definitely worth doing, and you'll get a result quicker.
All right, great. So I'm going to tell everybody how to get in touch with you. I'm also going to put it in the text of the description of the podcast in case you're needing to grab that. But Lasser Law Group could be found at Lasser, LASSERLG.com. That's LASSERLG.com. Your phone number is 212-292-3075. And your email is slasser@lasserlg.com. Again, you can email the show at nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com, nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. If you found this helpful, would love it if you would subscribe to this if you haven't already and share it and hopefully mark it 5 stars so that we can keep growing our audience. And if you have any questions or if you have any topics you want covered, feel free to email me and we'll be happy to hit them in the future. Steve, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. I thought I think I learned something new every time I do one of these with somebody. So I definitely appreciate, you know, your expertise and spending an hour of your time with us.
No, it was great. I really enjoyed speaking with you, Mark, and hopefully everyone found it to be insightful. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time.
All right. Be well.